A UN resolution calls for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. We have reaction from Israel.
I don't know how it will be effect on us, but everybody should understand. It can't be a ceasefire without bringing them home.
Plus, Vladimir Putin continues to claim without evidence that Ukraine is responsible for the deadly shooting in Moscow.
President Volodymyr Zelensky rejected Putin's accusations of Ukraine's involvement in the terrorist attack. The United States has also said there is no evidence of Ukrainian involvement.
Plus, a bridge collapsed in Baltimore, and Turkey is preparing to go on the offensive in Iraq. Today is Tuesday, March 26th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The Pentagon says Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin will meet with Israel's Minister of Defense on Tuesday to discuss ways to address the Hamas threat other than conducting a ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Tuesday's meeting comes at a time of rising tensions between the two countries. Pentagon spokesman Major General Pat Ryder tells reporters that Austin's planned meeting with Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is still on, despite the fact that Israel abruptly canceled the visit of a high-level delegation to Washington this week. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled that visit in protest over Monday's UN Security Council decision calling for an immediate ceasefire. Netanyahu has vowed to press ahead with Israel's offensive into Rafah, saying it's the only way to defeat Hamas. He blasted a UN Security Council resolution calling for a pause to the fighting, saying on Tuesday that it had emboldened Hamas to reject a separate ceasefire proposal. The U.S. does not fully support the resolution, and Israel doesn't support it at all because the resolution does not condemn Hamas for the October 7th attacks, which started the war, and it doesn't make a ceasefire conditional on Hamas releasing the remaining hostages. Not surprisingly, many in Israel see getting the hostages back as the highest priority of the moment. Shlomi Berger is a relative of a hostage.
What happened today in the U.N.? I don't know how it will be effect on us, but everybody should understand. It can't be a ceasefire without bringing them home. It can't be a ceasefire without bringing them home. It's not possible. First bring them home, and then it'll be a ceasefire. This is the most logic thing that we can do.
For a deeper dive on the UN resolution, my colleague Scott Walterman spoke with Atalia Omer. She's a professor of Religion, Conflict, and Peace Studies at the Keio School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame.
Tell me what the United Nations did today.
Yeah, so finally, after many failed attempts to pass a resolution in the Security Council, a resolution was passed with the U.S. Abstention for an immediate ceasefire for the remaining of the month of Ramadan, with an anticipation that it will lead to a more sustainable situation in Gaza.
Does the resolution actually carry any weight? Does Israel have to and Hamas have to abide?
Technically, yes, it is expected that the parties will abide by the resolution. It already looks like on the ground that Israel is not abiding by the resolution, with continuous and relentless attacks on Rafah and other areas of Gaza still ongoing. And of course, a very defiant attitude from Netanyahu with the cancellation of the visit of the senior advisors to the White House as, in reaction to the U.S. Reluctance this time to veto the resolution.
The split between the United States and Israel on this, is this unusual?
Yeah, it's a real departure from a long history of the United States giving, in addition to the military aid and the financial aid, also giving a diplomatic shield in the United Nations. Although the resolution itself, and the fact that the U.S. Abstained rather than voted in favor, shows that there is a strategy in mind in terms of the United States to pressure Israel to change course, because really the war cannot be sustained without the United States, without the U.S. support.
Scott Walterman hosts International Edition here on The Voice of America. He was speaking to Atalia Omer of Notre Dame's Keough School of Global Affairs. The United Nations Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza has not had an immediate impact on the ceasefire talks ongoing in Doha. This according to Qatar's foreign ministry spokesperson, Majed Al Ansari.
We haven't seen any immediate effect on the talks. They are, as I said, they are ongoing as they were before the decision was taking place.
For weeks, the sides have been discussing a potential truce of around 42 days, during which around 40 Israeli hostages would be released in return for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. Now, back to Israel. There is an Israeli law that grants exemptions from military service for ultra-Orthodox Jews. It's due to expire at the end of the month, paving the way for their possible conscription. Most ultra-Orthodox oppose serving in the army, and their parties are threatening to topple the government if the status quo is changed. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Since the beginning of the war in Gaza on October 7th, Israel has called up nearly 300,000 reservists. This was in addition to the regular standing army, in which almost 90% of Israeli Jewish youth serve. In contrast, among ultra-Orthodox Jewish young men, only about 3% are drafted into the Israeli army. This almost blanket exemption from the draft was granted to the ultra-Orthodox so they can study the Torah in religious institutions instead of doing military service. But it is now the subject of heated public debate. Yohanan Plesner is the president of the Israel Democracy Institute, a research organization in Jerusalem.
Public opinion polls clearly demonstrate that Israelis care deeply about the issue of recruitment and are deeply worried about the exemption for the ultra-Orthodox community exemption from service. This has been the case before October 7th. And now, given the war situation and the increasing burden on the serving population, this is extremely disconcerting for the majority of the population.
The exemption policy was initiated when the State of Israel was founded over 75 years ago. Then 400 ultra-Orthodox students received exemptions, while last year that number surged to 66,000. Israel's Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that these exemptions are discriminatory and demanded that successive governments compel the ultra-Orthodox to be drafted. The court says the change must be made into law by the end of March. But ultra-Orthodox parties are an essential part of Prime Minister Netanyahu's hardline coalition, and they are threatening to bring down the government if their military exemptions are canceled. Israel's chief Sephardic rabbi declared that if a law is passed to draft all ultra-Orthodox men into the military, the men would leave the country. Ultra-Orthodox demonstrations against the army draft have been stormy and sometimes violent. Israel Kaya attended a recent demonstration.
They want us, the Orthodox people here in Israel, to go to the Israeli army. They have one intention. They want us to be not religious. Therefore, we prefer to die. We don't mind going to prison. We prefer to die and not go to the Israeli army.
The ultra-Orthodox live in insular communities completely separate from secular Israeli society. They say that going to the army could tempt many of the young men to abandon their religious way of life. But there are some voices in the ultra-Orthodox community who favor military service, as long as the army would provide strictly kosher food and keep men and women separate. Itzik Crumbi runs a vocational training center that works to integrate the ultra-Orthodox into the workforce.
It's not sustainable to hold such a big community in such a small state that are not serving in the army, and especially after October 7th. We need the soldiers. The army needs the soldiers. So we need to find a way how to let Haredim join the war, join the army, and serve in the army like everyone. And from the other way, keep their identity and way of life.
While the debate rages on whether to end the ultra-Orthodox military service exemption, Israeli lawmakers have proposed increasing military service for both regular and reserve soldiers. This has brought renewed protests against the Netanyahu government and further raised calls for the ultra-Orthodox to share the burden. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Moving now to Ukraine, where the Navy continues to attack the Russian Black Sea fleet in Crimea, while Russian forces are intensifying the shelling of the Ukrainian energy system. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Ukrainian Navy forces confirmed the hit of a large amphibious assault ship docked in the Black Sea. Interestingly, the ship belonged to Ukraine before the Russian occupation of Crimea and Russian forces captured it in 2014. According to the spokesman of the Ukrainian Navy, Dmytro Platinchuk, over the past year, the Russians have been restoring the combat capability of the ship to use it in the war with Ukraine. He stated that the hit by a Ukrainian Neptune missile was confirmed and damage reported. The scale of damage has been verified. Currently, the ship is not operational. It's all part of Ukraine's ongoing focus on the Black Sea. A couple of days before, the Defense Forces of Ukraine struck other large amphibious ships as well as the communications center and several infrastructure facilities of the Russian Black Sea Fleet in Sevastopol. According to Ukrainian officials, Ukraine will continue to strike Russian military facilities in Crimea. Meanwhile, Russian attacks on the Ukrainian energy system continue. New damages of the energy facilities were reported in the southern regions of Ukraine, Odessa and Mykolaiv, and the city of Kharkiv. President Zelensky reported the latest update.
Odessa and Mykolaiv. After the attacks on power facilities, the situation is complicated. All the necessary services and repair crews were involved. In the afternoon, there was another strike on Odessa. People were injured. Kharkiv is still in a particularly challenging situation. But every day, energy supply to the city is being gradually restored.
In Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin admitted that the terrorist attack in Krokus City Hall on March 22nd was committed by radical Islamists. Still though, he blamed the shooting on those who are fighting Russia at the hands of the Kyiv regime. President Volodymyr Zelensky rejected Putin's accusations of Ukraine's involvement in the terrorist attack. The United States has also said there is no evidence of Ukrainian involvement. Again, President Zelensky.
Everyone is a terrorist to him, except for himself, although he has been fueled by terror for two decades already.
Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
New Zealand said on Tuesday that a Chinese state-sponsored hacking operation targeted New Zealand's parliament in 2021. This just one day after the U.S. and Britain took action in response to their own attacks by China-backed hacking groups. VOA's Laurie London has more.
New Zealand officials say hackers linked to the Chinese government targeted its parliament in 2021. The allegation Tuesday comes a day after American and British authorities announced a set of criminal charges and sanctions against seven hackers, all believed to be in China, who they say targeted U.S. officials, journalists, corporations, and pro-democracy activists. Britain accused the hackers of trying to break into the email accounts of U.K. lawmakers who were critical of China. U.S. Justice Department officials say the intention of the campaign was to harass critics of the Chinese government, steal trade secrets, and spy on and track high-level political figures. China's foreign ministry dismissed the allegations as typical political manipulation. Laurie London, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Chinese nationals targeted in a Pakistan suicide attack. We'll have that story soon. First, though, in the United States, a major highway bridge in the eastern city of Baltimore collapsed after it was struck by a cargo ship. The ship was having mechanical problems and radioed to authorities that it had lost power. A construction crew was fixing potholes on the bridge at the time, and 8 people fell into the river, where water temperatures were only 8 degrees Celsius. 2 people were rescued, one of whom is unharmed, the other critically injured. At least 6 are known to be still missing. Video shows the ship apparently losing power before striking the bridge. Local authorities have said there's no indication that this was a terrorist attack. Turkey says it's preparing to launch a major military operation into Iraq against Kurdish rebels operating from there. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan vows to end what he says is the latest threat posed by the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which has been fighting Turkey for decades. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Ankara is looking to Baghdad and Tehran for support.
For 2 years, Turkish forces have been carrying out military incursions into neighboring northern Iraq against bases of the PKK, which has been fighting for Kurdish minority rights in Turkey for decades. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is now vowing to permanently end the threat posed by the PKK and its affiliates in neighboring Syria. Mesut Jarshan is a presidential advisor and professor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
In the coming days, it is expected that PKK targets along the approximately 330 kilometers in Iraqi border. By securing the Iraqi border, Turkey is expected to create 40-kilometer new security corridor similar to the one in Syria.
Ankara got a boost this month in its war against the PKK when Baghdad banned the Kurdish group. Erdogan is also developing close ties with the leadership of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan regional government. Analysts say such cooperation is vital to Ankara's goal of eradicating the PKK threat. Murat Aslan is with the Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research, an Ankara think tank.
Turkey will focus on the capacity of Iraqi security forces together with Kurdish regional governments, Peshmerga. And Turkey wants a full encirclement of PKK members in Iraq and then destroy them, neutralize them.
In April, Erdogan is scheduled to visit Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan regional government and Baghdad, where the PKK is expected to top the agenda. Analysts say enhanced bilateral trade, as well as increasing international transit through Iraq to Turkey, gives Erdogan new leverage with Baghdad. Aydin Selcan is a former senior Turkish diplomat who served in Iraq and is now a foreign policy analyst for Turkey's MediaScope news portal.
The carrot is the development road connecting Basra to the Turkish border, which will bring billions of US dollars to Baghdad's coffers. So for that project to be realistic, there should be stability and security in Iraq. So in a way, Ankara wishes to repackage the combat against PKK within that project.
But analysts warn that the PKK's headquarters is in Iraq's mountainous Kandil region, bordering Iran. That means any operation will require Tehran's cooperation. Murat Aslan is with the Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research, an Ankara think tank.
Kandil Mountain is divided between Iran and Iraq. Whenever an operation is planned and implemented in the region, they go to Iran, enjoy a safe haven and come back. So this campaign should be complemented by Iranian efforts, but it's not a guarantee. We will see what happens.
The rivalry between Turkey and Iran is increasing across the region, and analysts say Tehran may be reluctant to accommodate Ankara's demands, further raising tensions. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
In Pakistan, 5 Chinese nationals and their Pakistani driver were killed in a suicide attack near a hydroelectric power plant they were helping construct. It's the latest in a string of attacks targeting Chinese people or investment in Pakistan. For more, I'm joined by Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad.
Yes, it is evident, and in fact, even officials are now describing it as a targeted attack. And this is not the first time that Chinese engineers associated with this project have been attacked in 2021, in July of 2021. A similar bus convoy carrying Chinese experts and laborers to the site were hit by a suicide car bomber.
Isn't Pakistan looking for Chinese investment? Why would they be targets of assassination like that?
Well, it's a good question. This incident, today's incident and the previous attack in this location, Chinese and Pakistani investigators suspect were carried out by Uyghur Muslims, you know, these extremist insurgents who are active in Western Chinese province of Xinjiang. They also, you know, the Chinese have complained to the Taliban in neighboring Afghanistan that these militants are sheltering in Afghanistan. And Pakistan has repeatedly complained to the Taliban government in Afghanistan that militant groups such as the anti-Pakistan TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, and these East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which China has declared a terrorist organization for attacks inside China, that they are sheltering in Afghanistan and carrying out these attacks, basically to undermine Pakistan's close economic cooperation with China lately.
And I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there for today. VOA's Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad. Ayaz, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Much like Pakistan, the small Himalayan country of Nepal is situated between India and China, with both countries using infrastructure projects to compete for influence. Henry Wilkins reports from Kathmandu.
These rough, dusty tracks are where the Kathmandu Terai Expressway was due to be finished this year. But the project that was supposed to link the capital to the country's south is only one quarter of the way done, local media reports say. And officials say it won't be completed until 2027 at the earliest. Residents along the route say they're tired of the lack of progress. Road construction has been held up in a court battle between Indian and Chinese companies who bid for the project. India and China are vying for influence here, largely by offering development projects and financing for them. The country is strategically important for both, as the Himalayan mountain range, which runs through Nepal, forms a barrier between them. Analysts say Nepal is walking a tightrope to stay neutral.
They just try to work according to their interest. Both the countries put their interest first before serving us. We need to trade consciously while taking any help from them. So we don't want to fall in their geopolitical quagmire.
Pokhara International Airport serves one of Nepal's tourism hotspots. It was built by Chinese contractors with Chinese financing and opened in January 2023. It's yet to welcome any scheduled international flights, however. Local media say India is dragging its heels in allowing flights to go there because of the airport's Chinese connections. At least six other China-backed infrastructure projects are delayed, according to the Kathmandu Post. Analysts tell VOA the government is wary of finalising the terms of the project for fear of giving away too much power to China. Politicians say that India is a more natural partner for Nepal. As Nepal continues the balancing act, this stretch of the ring road around the capital, Kathmandu, recently expanded thanks to a Chinese-Nepali joint project. Roadside business owners say they are just happy to see some development.
Now shoe shops, hotels, cell phone shops have all opened here. The old shops have been renovated and improved. And if you look down the road, the stores that used to be empty are now full and occupied.
As delays to other projects continue, so too does India and China's battle for hearts, minds and roads in Nepal. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Kathmandu, Nepal.
And that's going to end today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.